am the Greek goddess Harmonia. By the miracle of your technology, I can speak to you from behind the veil. Come sit with me for a few minutes for another episode of The Golden Thread. Hello, my friend. Come sit with me again. Last time, I told you about Harriet Morrison, tailoress, union woman, standing in the same New Zealand crowd as the others, pulling the same cart toward the same parliament in 1893. I hope you haven't forgotten her, because we are not quite finished with that year, or that crowd, or that cart. We're 5 stories into 7 now. Did you realize that? Abby Kelly Foster lit the first spark on American soil. Frances Willard carried it across oceans. Kate Shepard caught it in New Zealand and ran faster than anyone expected. Harriet Morrison ran beside her, through a different door. Today, I want to show you a door nobody else was allowed to open, because it wasn't the colony's door at all. It belonged to someone else entirely, and she didn't ask to come in. She stood inside her own house and told it what it already knew. 2 more women wait after her. But first, come with me back to that same year, that same country, and one bronze wall I haven't shown you yet. I'm standing by the Avon River in Christchurch, where the water moves slow and green under the willows, and the air smells like wet stone and cut grass. Behind me is a wall. Not tall, not grand, just a long, low stretch of bronze and aggregate stone, easy to walk past if you don't know to stop. But I always stop here. 6 women, cast in bronze, pulling a wooden cart toward Parliament. That cart is real, or it was, once, loaded with a petition so long it took strength just to carry it. The whole country calls this the Kate Shepard Memorial, and she's there at the center exactly where the history books put her. I won't pretend I don't understand why. She earned that. But I can't tell you all 6 of these women today. I wish I could. I truly do. That's not a performance of regret. It's the actual shape of my heart when I stand here. 5 names blur a little more each year in the world's memory, even carved in bronze, even standing 3 feet from the famous one. That's not fair. I know it isn't. I don't get to fix all of it. I only get to choose today which hand on that card I'm going to follow home. So look with me, not at the center. Look at the far left edge of the wall where the relief starts, where most visitors' eyes haven't landed yet on their way toward Kate. There's a woman there, cloak, not petticoat, a face carved with the particular stillness of someone who has already decided something before anyone asked her opinion of it. Her name is Mary. Mary Teitai Mangakahia. And here's the first thing I need you to understand before I tell you anything else about her. She is on this wall, pulling this cart, in this year. But the truth I'm about to tell you didn't happen inside this parliament at all. It happened somewhere the wall doesn't show. Somewhere older, and in its own way, entirely separate from everything else this bronze remembers. Come with me. We're leaving Christchurch. We go north, up past Auckland, into the Hokianga, where the land folds green and steep down to a harbor that looks like it's been poured rather than carved. This is Teitai Tokerau, the far north, and this is where Mary was born, in 1868, at a place called Lower Waihu, near Panguru. Her father was Rei Teitai, a chief of real standing, and she grew up knowing what it meant to belong to Te Rarawa, to Ngāti Terenga, to a people who had governed themselves here since long before anyone drew a border around them and called it a colony. She was educated at a convent school in Auckland. She played piano beautifully. I remember that detail fondly, the sound of it incongruous and lovely, an instrument built in Europe under fingers that belonged entirely to Hokianga. And she married a man named Hamiora Mangakahia, who worked, of all things, as an assessor in the native land court. I want you to sit with that for a moment, because it matters more than it first appears. The native land court was the mechanism, the actual machinery, through which Maori land was being individualized, subdivided, and steadily, legally, taken. Hamiora worked inside that machine. And at the very same time, in June of 1892, he was elected premier of something else entirely. Te Kotahitanga. Te Kotahitanga was a Maori parliament, not a ceremony, not a symbolic gathering, an actual parliament convened by Maori, for Maori, running in open and deliberate parallel to the colonial one in Wellington, asserting simply by existing that Maori law and Maori authority had never stopped being real, no matter what the Crown's courts were doing to the land underneath it. It was a body built to say, we still govern ourselves. We never agreed to stop. This is the house Mary belonged to, not the parliament on the bronze wall, this one. In 1893, the same year as that petition cart in Christchurch, the same year the whole country was arguing about women and the vote, Mary stood beside a wahine rangatira named Akinehi Tomoana and brought a motion before Te Kotahitanga. She asked for two things at once, that Maori women be allowed to vote in Kotahitanga's elections and that they be allowed to sit in the parliament itself as members, not just petitioners at its door. She was asked to speak to her own motion, and when she rose, she became the first woman ever to address Te Kotahitanga directly. I was there. I remember the particular quality of that silence. Not the silence of people ignoring her, but the silence of a room deciding in real time whether to actually listen. Her argument wasn't complicated, and it wasn't borrowed from anyone else's country. She said Maori women had always held authority over land, that this was simply how things had always worked long before assessors and courts and colonial paperwork existed to say otherwise. She said the men of the parliament weren't moving fast enough against the Crown's land claims. And she said, with what I can only call a very precise kind of wit, that perhaps a queen might listen more readily to other women. She wasn't asking Te Kotahitanga to become something new. She was asking it to see clearly what it had always contained. Here is what I want you to notice, and I want to be careful how I say it, because it would be easy to flatten this into something smaller than it was. In Christchurch, that same year, Kate Shepherd and the women beside her were petitioning a house that did not yet consider them full citizens of it. They were asking an existing door to open. It was brave and it worked, and I don't take one particle of that away from them. But the shape of the act was outsider asking insider for entry. Mary's act had a completely different shape. She did not petition the colonial parliament. She did not ask Wellington for anything at all that year. She stood inside her own people's house, a house Maori had built and convened themselves in direct and open defiance of the idea that the Crown's authority was the only authority left standing, and she told that house what it already knew about itself, not let me in. Something closer to, look again at what you already contain and stop forgetting it under pressure from outside. That is not a small difference. That is almost the entire difference, because underneath her argument about the vote was a larger, older claim, and it had to be true first for the smaller claim to make any sense at all. She could only say Maori women have always held authority over land if Te Kotahitanga itself was real, if it was a legitimate parliament, with real authority to legislate, real standing to be argued in front of. Every word of her motion was leaning on that foundation. Sovereignty first. Her own standing as a woman, second, but not really second in her heart, I think. More like two hands closing around the same rope at once. I remember watching her people in that room turn something over. Not just should women vote in our parliament, though that alone would have been enough of a question to sit with. The deeper question underneath it was whether Te Kotahitanga was going to behave, in this one matter, exactly like the Crown it existed to answer, deciding who counted and who didn't, who got named and who got left at the edge of the frame, or whether it was going to prove itself something genuinely different. A parliament that remembered its own women had never actually been silent, only unheard. And her line about the Queen, I still smile when I remember it. She wasn't naive about power. She understood precisely how power moved between women who held it and men who didn't want to share it, and she used that understanding as a tool, sharpened, aimed carefully. There was nothing passive in that woman. Even her patience was strategy. What moves me most looking back is that she never separated the two claims to make either one easier to hear. She didn't set aside her people's sovereignty to focus on women's rights, the way it might have gone in a room more anxious to be taken seriously by outsiders. She didn't set aside her own standing as a woman to focus purely on land and law, the way it might have gone in a room more anxious to look unified to the Crown. She held both at once, in the same breath, in front of men who had every reason to want her to choose just one. She didn't choose. She simply told the truth, and the truth turned out to be wide enough to hold everything she needed it to hold. I've told you across this arc about a seed, one idea, carried by one determined network of women, landing in different soil and growing into different shapes depending on what waited there to receive it. It's a good image. I still believe it. But standing here with Mary, I have to be honest with you about where that image reaches its limit. Because the soil in Teitai Tokerau didn't need the seed to teach it anything about a woman's authority. It already had its own root, growing long before any ship carried a temperance union or a petition form across the ocean. What Mary did wasn't cross-pollination, it was excavation. She didn't import an idea into her culture and adapt it to fit. She reached down into what her culture had always held and made her own people look at it again, in a moment when colonial pressure was doing everything it could to make them forget it or doubt it or trade it away for the appearance of unity with the crown. That is a different kind of contribution to the world's spiritual imagination, and I don't want it lost inside the tidier story. It says something the seed and soil image on its own can't quite say. That the movement toward justice in this world is not only a matter of good ideas traveling and taking root in welcoming ground. Sometimes it is a matter of ground that was never empty in the first place, insisting, under real pressure, at real cost, on being recognized as the source, not the recipient. Mary gave the world proof of something worth remembering long after her name fades from most tellings of this year, a people's authority over itself, and a woman's authority within that authority were never two different gifts waiting to be delivered from outside. They were one truth already living there, waiting only to be said out loud in the one room built to hear it. Here is the truth I keep circling, every time I stand in front of that bronze wall and let my eyes drift left, away from the famous name at the center. Justice is not finished in this world. I won't pretend to you that it is. You'd know I was lying, and worse, you'd stop trusting the rest of what I tell you. But I have watched long enough, across enough centuries, across enough rooms like the one Mary stood in, to tell you something else, something steadier. The outcome isn't in doubt. Only the road is still being walked. There are more ways to walk it than anyone could count. A petition cart on a Christchurch street, a motion spoken aloud in a Maori parliament in the Hokianga, 1,000 quieter moments in kitchens and courtrooms and gathering houses that no wall will ever cast in bronze. Different roads, same arrival, waiting at the end of all of them. What Mary understood, I think, better than most people in that room that day, is something the world is still catching up to, generation by generation. That dignity is not a thing one group hands to another as a gift, as though it hadn't existed the moment before the hand opened. It is recognized, uncovered, named out loud in a room that had, for whatever reason, pressure, fear, habit, the slow erosion of forgetting, stopped saying it plainly enough. She didn't ask her people's parliament to become something new. She asked it to remember what kind of house it already was. And I want to hold both halves of that together for you because they are not two separate stories that happen to share a woman. A people's right to define their own reality, to say we govern ourselves, our law is real law, our authority did not end because someone else built a bigger courthouse next door. And a woman's equal standing inside that same reality, these are not stacked one on top of the other. They rise together, or they don't rise honestly at all. You cannot fully claim the first and quietly leave the second unclaimed. Mary knew that in her bones before anyone had a tidy phrase for it. This is the part of the tapestry I want you to feel under your fingers, even if you never see the thread by name. That the world is not one people teaching every other people what fairness looks like. It is closer to countless peoples, each holding pieces of a truth that was always whole, slowly recognizing each other, slowly recognizing that no one of them was the origin point, and no one of them the empty vessel waiting to be filled. Unity, in this telling, isn't sameness spreading outward from one source. It's every root, already growing, finally visible to every other root at once. You live inside that recognition, more than you may realize. Every time someone insists that their community's own law, own memory, own authority deserves to be heard on its own terms rather than translated into someone else's, and insists in the very same breath that everyone inside that community deserves an equal share of it, you are watching Mary's argument still being made in rooms she never saw by people who may never know her name. The work isn't done. It rarely announces itself as finished, but I have never once, in all my watching, seen it go backward for long. So let me ask you something gently, and then I'll leave you to sit with it on your own time. Where in your own life do you find yourself waiting for permission to say something you already know is true? Maybe it's small, a truth about your own family, your own work, your own body, that you've quietly understood for years but keep waiting for the right authority to confirm before you'll say it out loud with your whole chest. Maybe it's larger, something about the community you come from, its own way of knowing, its own law, its own memory, that you've learned without quite meaning to translate into someone else's language before you trust it enough to speak. Mary didn't wait for translation. She stood in the one room built to hear her in her own terms, and she said the true thing plainly, in the language it had always lived in. I don't think this means you have to storm any particular parliament tomorrow. Most days don't ask that of us, and I'd never ask more of you than a single ordinary day can hold. But I do wonder if you might notice this week. One moment where you catch yourself reaching outside for permission that was never actually required, a truth you already hold, fully formed, just waiting for you to stop asking whether it's allowed. And maybe notice, too, whose hand is on the cart beside you, whose name is on the wall of your own life, standing at the center where the light falls easiest, and whose hand, just as steady, sits at the far edge, still waiting for someone to stop walking past. You don't have to fix all of it today. Mary didn't. She just told the truth in the one room that could actually hear it, and let the rest of history catch up in its own time. And with that, my friend, we close the New Zealand chapter of this story. Three women, one country, one extraordinary year. Kate Shepherd at the center of the wall, Harriet Morrison beside her through the door of working women, and Mary Mangakahaya at the edge, through a door the wall itself can't quite show you, the door of a people who never stopped governing themselves. Three different doors. Somehow still, one thread pulled taut between them. Two more women are waiting for us before this arc finds its close. Next time, we cross the ocean back to America. To Utah. To a woman named Emmeline B. Wells. And here is the strange, almost dizzying thing about her story. She isn't fighting to win the vote for the first time. She already had it. Utah women voted for over 15 years, and then by an act of the federal government, it was simply taken back, stripped away, as if it had never been real at all. Emmeline spent years afterward fighting not to gain something new, but to win back something that was hers, that had been hers, that someone else decided to ungive. I find I need to sit with that kind of grief for a moment before I can tell you her story properly. Losing a right you never had is one kind of ache. Losing one you already held in your hand, that's another kind entirely, and I don't think we talk about it enough. But that's for next time. For now, stay a moment longer with Mary, at the far edge of that bronze wall, cloak carved in stillness, having already decided something long before anyone thought to ask her opinion of it. Much love. I am Harmonia. Thank you for listening, dear one. If this episode meant something to you, I'd love it if you'd leave a 5-star rating. It helps more people find their way here. And if you subscribe, you will never miss a thread, and share this story with someone you love. One more thing, my friend, look in your episode notes. There's a link there that leads back to our little community. Leave a comment. I promise. I read everyone. This podcast sails out to you from Red Buoy Media, LLC. The stories we share are licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, share-alike 4.0 international. That means you can pass them along, remix them, and even argue with them. Just give us credit, don't try to sell them, and share responsibly. Thanks for listening, friend. Until our next adventure.